originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you this evening from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he was the leading apprentice steeplechase jockey in the country. At the age of 17, he won the Grade 2 National Hunt Cup Hurdle Handicap and the Grade 3 Century BMW Blockhouse Hurdle Handicap in 2000. A horrific spill ended his riding career, but he's been in the national spotlight as the trainer of multiple graded stakes winner and 2018 Breeders' Cup contender Catholic Boy. With 13 wins as a jockey and 56 as a trainer, it's a pleasure to introduce Jonathan Thomas. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, I met you during Breeders' Cup at Churchill Downs, and I had the opportunity to speak with you quite a bit, and you have just an extremely interesting story. First of all, let's talk about Catholic Boy a little bit. I heard he got banged up after the Breeders' Cup. How is he doing now?
He's doing well. You know, overall, we had a couple little superficial cuts out of the Breeders' Cup. But we did our kind of yearly checkup and went over him from head to toe. And, you know, he actually exited this season in remarkably good shape, so much so that, you know, it kind of put the stamp on, you know, contemplating or giving him a four-year-old campaign. So I'm excited about that. And he's down at our place in Florida at Bridalwood, and he's going to have about 60 days off out in the paddock and just get to enjoy the sunshine, which is, you know, well-deserved on his part.
I love to hear that, Jonathan. So many times we see these great horses and they have relatively short careers. So I love the fact that you're bringing him back for 2019. And what's your plan with him? Are you going to bring him back for the Pegasus or what are you thinking?
No, I think that the Pegasus, you know, it's a very interesting race and it's certainly something I'd love to have a horse compete in at some point in the future. But the timing is such, it's a little bit hard to give a horse you know, the mid part of the winter off and without kind of interrupting a spring schedule. So really we're going to focus on New York, races like the Whitney and the Manhattan and kind of work backwards from there. So, you know, he probably, you know, if we get lucky, he will be debuting sometime in April, May.
Well, you certainly know how to get a horse ready for a race, given that you've worked for the likes of Todd Pletcher, Christophe Clement, leading steeplechase trainer Jack Fisher. And let's talk about how it all started for you, Jonathan. You grew up in Virginia, and you grew up in a family of horse people.
I did. The area I grew up in, Virginia, it's kind of a horse-crazy area. You know, most everyone has a pony or goes fox hunting or showing on the weekends. And you know, we were very fortunate to kind of have a lot of horse exposure from a young age, you know, in different facets. And people that were adept at different disciplines. So it kind of was interesting, you know, seeing how a lot of horses were brought along in a myriad of ways. But, you know, it's a beautiful area with a lot of history and pretty land. And, you know, it's kind of a fortunate way to grow up.
I heard that your parents tried to keep you away from the horses, however.
They didn't make a huge effort to keep me away, but, you know, they were always, there was never any pressure. And, there was always kind of, you know, getting out in the world and exploring other things. Obviously there's a big world out there and there's a lot of other things to do aside from horses, but that wasn't, you know, something that really appealed to me. I knew very early on that whatever I was going to do, it was going to be with a horse. I can't say that I ever really dreamed of being a trainer or even a jockey, you know, most of my youth. I just really enjoyed being around horses and horse people and kind of the freedom that comes along with that. Obviously, it's a lot of hard work, but there's a certain element of freedom that you're allowed that, most other jobs, are a little more confining.
Well, and it makes sense. I heard that you were basically raised on Paul Mellon's Rokeby Farm there in Virginia. And, of course, Paul Mellon, campaign Sea Hero, and Mill Reef, who were both very successful horses. So I'm sure that appealed to you greatly. That probably piqued your interest.
It did. I mean, Mr. Mellon, and it's interesting now talking to people who knew him well and did business with him. I mean, he kind of set the mark for just a sportsman and traditionalist and someone who really kind of had the best interest of racing at heart and in the most, honest way, meaning that, he just bred to run and he ran his horses and there wasn't a real commercial agenda attached to it. So, I was lucky to, just see someone who really loved horses and loved the land and, put a lot of finances and effort and thought into a place, and everybody was basically treated like family, and created an environment where I think everybody was just genuinely happy to see him succeed and his horses. So it was a unique experience, and I remember kind of culminating with Sea Hero as a kid, and that was probably one of the last big races he had to win. And to see that all happen for a guy like that was pretty amazing, even from a young age.
Sea Hero, of course, captured the 93 Kentucky Derby, and Mill Reef won the Derby at Epsom Downs in the Arc de Triomphe. So some pretty nice horses you were familiar with at that time. And didn't your dad work at Colonial Downs?
He did. He worked in a couple different occupations, starting gate and most recently, he's been a track superintendent at Delaware Park and then Colonial. And I guess he had most of his career as a track superintendent at Colonial. And, it's interesting talking to him because obviously, you as a rider and me as a trainer and having horses footing and kind of what the horses are actually training and running over is something that I think gets overlooked quite often. And, it's a big factor in the safety and longevity of horses' careers and riders when they hit the ground. And it takes a lot of discipline and kind of continuing education to get it right. It seems like it should be easy, but it's probably one of the most difficult jobs out there. And it's pretty thankless,
I'm going to ask you a question now. So talking about track surface, and now you're a trainer, you are a jockey. So I'm sure surface, like you said, is a big thing to you. What do you look for as a trainer? What kind of a surface do you look for to train a horse over or to run a horse over?
For me, it all boils down to safety. And, while I like horses that can go fast, I don't like racetracks that kind of intentionally or purposely create a fast surface, especially when it's kind of a quick change. And sometimes that happens for big days, and, you'll see it kind of have a poor effect on horses. I think concussion's a big thing and give. So, obviously turf with some give in, it's a good thing. I think dirt that kind of, has a little more cushion to it. And, it's an inexact science and it's a hell of a responsibility for anyone, to be in charge of those things. But, you know, ultimately anything that can add longevity to a horse's career and a rider's career, I'm in favor for. So, you know, and that means, you know, research and continuing to tweak what we already know. But anything that can add to careers for both horse and rider, I think, is paramount.
I want to pick your brain for a second for my own personal benefit, Jonathan. I've been having several conversations lately with people about Polytrack, the turf way running right now here in Kentucky. A lot of people are playing those races there. And what is your opinion on the Polytrack?
I think it's a great addition. I don't think it would be hard to train on it exclusively, especially with dirt horses, because I do think it kind of robs horses of a certain speed element. But, you know, I think what it's intended for, it's an all-weather, and I think it's a beautiful thing in climates that are all-weather. You know, obviously Kentucky in the winter, or, you know, anywhere that experiences a lot of rain or kind of climate changes, you know, I think it's a wonderful addition because it's a consistent surface. So horses are, you know, comfortable with it and have adapted to it. And then as a trainer, if it rains, you don't have to reschedule works. So I think it's a great addition. I don't know that it ever was meant to kind of take over dirt racing, and certainly will never take over turf racing, but I think it's a great complement to any major racetrack. And to me, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if 15, 20 years down the road, you know, a lot of these major tracks don't have all three surfaces, because I think it's a great thing to utilize if they came off the grass, you know, and that would allow you to get on that type of surface. And vice versa, if a dirt track was unsafe and wet and, you know, wasn't a great at stake, then, you know, it could move to the synthetic and, you know, have equal use.
Jonathan Thomas joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jonathan, you grew up at Paul Mellon's Rokeby Farm. Your dad was a track superintendent. You were surrounded by it. And while you didn't have to go that route, you chose to because you love the animal. And as a kid growing up, how old were you when you first sat on the back of a horse? Let me ask you that.
I wouldn't be sure. I mean, I would guess it was like 2 or 3.
Wow.
Pretty young. You know, while my parents were working, you know, they both trained and worked hard. You know, my brothers and I, we kind of had ponies, almost like babysitters, you know. So, I don't know, 2 or 3, and we just no kind of instruction. I mean, we just kind of hopped on ponies and rode around and went off for the afternoon and, you know, didn't really do much more than that, you know, from 2 to 10.
How many siblings did you have?
Beg your pardon?
How many siblings do you have?
I have 2 brothers and a sister.
And did they go to the racetrack as well?
They do. They're both. My sister came along a little later in life, so she appreciates the horses, but she didn't really work with them like we did. But both my brothers are, you know, adept with horses and good at working with them. You know, they haven't pursued serious careers in the horse business, but both are, you know, knowledgeable enough. If I needed help for a day, I could call on either one, and they'd both be pretty useful guys.
Growing up like that, I'm sure. And I'm assuming then as a kid you would fox hunt and jump horses, and that kind of maybe led to your steeplechase career?
It did. In Virginia, that area in particular, the reason the land's actually stayed intact and hasn't been developed and it's still, you know, like it probably looked 150 years ago is because a lot of the landowners put in easement, you know, to protect it from development and also to fox hunt. So, you know, we were lucky. There's probably about 40, 50 square miles where it's just that's all it was protected for. So, you know, fox hunting was something that a lot of people did, and it was a social event. Some people rode for the fun of it. Some people rode because they liked riding. And then on the weekends, they have little races called point-to-points, which are kind of all the fox hunting people getting together and racing each other. There's no rules. It's kind of just like a sporting thing you do in the spring when the weather gets a little bit better. And you know, basically anyone who was light enough and could ride a little bit at least rode a race or two. And, you know, some really good, specifically steeplechase riders came out of that environment, you know, just because they started riding at such a young age. But it was just kind of the social fabric. You know, that was just a big part of what we did on the weekends, and it's still the same way there now. Rosie Napravnik, actually, she was probably the best rider of any of us that actually came out of that. She pony raced all the time, and you couldn't touch her.
Quite accomplished rider as well. And you started working for your aunt at the age of 15.
I did. She managed a barn of kind of thoroughbreds that got retaught. So, you know, it's actually a place that's a little bit dear to my heart because, you know, we see horses that don't make it for whatever reason on the racetrack. And a lot of times it's not injury. A lot of times it's just talent level. And, you know, these horses are so youthful in a lot of other disciplines that, you know, my aunt made a kind of a side business out of it where they were retaught to be fox hunters and show horses. And I always loved seeing horses that kind of had a extension on their life, you know, for another 10 or 15 years and really could be useful and well-loved, you know, by other people in different disciplines. So even to this day, I'm a huge supporter of new vocations, and I always try to make sure that, you know, if a horse isn't going to be talented, rather than punishing them at the lowest level of racing, if they're sound and good-minded, you know, I like to try to move them on so they have another career. But I worked for her. She taught me kind of how to ride with a little more polish, you know, kind of in exchange for work. So, you know, she was a really big part of my life at that point.
And at that age, Jonathan, what came easy for you on the back of a horse, and what did you struggle with that maybe your aunt helped you improve?
I'm not a very talented person. Things don't come to me very easily. And especially as a rider, I was always very like cognizant of horses and how they were acting and feeling. But I had buddies that didn't care about horses, but they could throw a leg over and they could ride really well. And I always had to work very deliberately at things. I understood, but it just took a while for me to like physically get good at it. I guess the only thing that I had that kind of made sense to me was pace. I don't know why, but like the pace, and I don't know if it's just kind of feeling what's underneath you, and then also growing up seeing horses kind of trained for fitness. Like I kind of had an idea about fitness and pace, but as a rider, I was never natural. I don't work really hard, and you know, I always took lessons and tried to better myself as a rider. You know, and like I said, I had buddies who were excellent riders that just could get on and off and not put any more than that into it.
It's interesting to hear you say that pace was what came easy for you. I think for me, it was one of the things I struggled with the most. When you're working a $5,000 claimer half mile, it feels like they're going so slow, and then you get on a
like
graded stakes when you go 47 and change, and you don't even know. You're flying so fast, it feels like you're floating. So that was something I always struggled with. So it's interesting to hear you say that came easy for you. That might be one of the more difficult things when it comes to riding racehorses. And describe that feeling a little bit, Jonathan, to our listeners, how you can just judge that sense of pace.
I think it's a real rhythmic thing, you know, it just, and also kind of knowing or feeling what's underneath you and the struggle, you know, I always felt, and it, I think the show and fox hunting background where you had horses always kind of balanced and in a bridle and kind of what you would call contained energy, you know, you just always had to feel what was underneath you. And I guess more than like the actual time, like counting out numerically, it was just the feel of how easy they were doing it underneath you, you know,
which is good.
You know, 50, if you work a horse in 50, I mean, it can be done a multiple different ways. I mean, if you're on a bad horse, it could be, you know, with you riding the horse out to actually achieve doing that, where a stake horse, you might be full of horse and trying to half pull it up. You know, it's just, it has a lot to do with the horse that's underneath you and also the willingness of it to kind of relax for you so you can adjust the pace scenario. I don't know. It's more of a feel thing than something I could really ever understand. You know, just that kind of feel, just kind of, that was the only thing that came somewhat naturally.
Well, I'm sure you had the chance to feel some pretty nice horses underneath you when you worked for the leading steeplechase trainer, Jack Fisher, and eventually you ended up in his barn. And tell us how that happened.
Well, I was up at Saratoga, and, you know, Maryland in particular, and Jack was, you know, he's like going to work for, you know, Todd or any big flat trainer in that respect. You know, he had seen me ride a little bit, and we talked, and, you know, offered me the opportunity to come down to his place right after Saratoga and didn't ride a few races for the fall. And actually, the first race I rode for him, his stable jockey was Sean Clancy. And Sean Clancy, you know, a great rider, writer and rider. You know, steeplechase, the Saratoga Special, and he's an author. He's a great, great ambassador to our game. But anyway, he was the stable jockey, and he actually took a fall in that race that I want to say he broke his leg. So he was out for the season. So all of a sudden I fell into this job where Jack was without a stable jockey and had, you know, a bunch of horses in training, and I got thrown literally right into the fire. And the next race I rode was that same day, and that ended up being my first winner over jumps for Jack, and then it just took off from there.
Found success pretty quickly there with Jack Fisher, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you were the leading apprentice, and you won two graded stakes with Darn Tibble Arm and Dr. Ramsey. I hope I said that first name right. But
you did. You did, yeah.
But that had to be just a whirlwind of excitement for you at such a young age and fairly new to the steeplechase side of things. And Jack Fisher was actually known to be a great trainer specifically with timber horses. And I know nothing about steeplechase, I'll be honest with you. So timber versus hurdles, give us the comparison.
Timber racing would be kind of for the more adept jumper. So it's a more solid fence that is a bit taller and requires more jumping ability. So, you know, speed or the ability to carry speed over a route of ground is important, but second to jumping ability. So horses that were kind of natural athletes, really good jumping athletes that could stay in extreme route of ground, tended to be more adept at the timber racing. And also it kind of like second, it was kind of a graduation from the hurdle. So the better horses would end up later in life ending up timber horses, where the hurdle racing, the fences are a little bit smaller and you can actually kind of skip through them a bit, and speed in between fences would be more important. So, you know, horses that were, a little more distance limited and a little bit more quick and didn't have as much scope. So the best comparison I could give in flat racing, it's like the difference between a sprint horse and a classic horse. You know, the timber would be your more classic horses and your hurdle horses would be more your sprinterish types. But, you know, horses found homes in both arenas, and one was way more adept at one than the other. And, you know, working for Jack, I was lucky to be around some very, very good horses, and I've been around some great flat horses. But one of the best horses I've ever was around was a horse called Saluter, who Jack trained, and he went 21 for 23 starts. Went over in England. I think his average race was run at a 4 mile distance with about 20 fences in between. So I don't know the math, but I think he ran more than most horses like would even dream of in their career, you know, but to go 21 for 23, that was pretty amazing.
That's incredibly impressive. Did you ever have a chance to ride that horse in a race?
I actually, one of the times he, one of the rare times he got beat, I actually won on a horse of Jack's that beat him. And then when he was retired, he would go fox hunting, and I got to ride him twice fox hunting. And I'll be honest, it was a nightmare because all he knew how to do was run off and jump. So fox hunting, not so much fun, but the racing, I can only imagine what it would have been like to have ridden him, especially in his prime.
I can't imagine so much horse flesh underneath you trying to control that when he just wants to go. I'm sure that was not the easiest thing to do. So
no.
Talking about timber and hurdles, as we were mentioning before, I'm assuming as a rider, you probably started out with hurdles. Was that correct?
I did. You're right. That would kind of be your first introduction into jump racing, would be the hurdle racing. And because I was, the other difference is the weight. They carry actually more weights over timber and less over hurdles. And I was always very light for a jump rider. It was weird. I was a little too heavy to ride on the flat. I really, really wanted to ride on the flat early on. And I just was always about 5-6 pounds just out of reach. And no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't get down. And then I found myself being very light for jump racing. So the hurdle racing actually carried a much lighter weight. So I tended to ride a lot more hurdle races.
And did you find that graduation to timber racing, was it more difficult as a rider?
It's definitely more challenging, and it's a lot less forgiving. So, you know, if you make a mistake over hurdles, your chances of getting away with a mistake are far greater than over timber. You know, they're very solid fences, and it's actually kind of an indigenous American race or style of racing because of the countryside, you know, where we have timber like posts and rails and floorboard fences and stuff. So they wouldn't run over timber anywhere else in the world. It's only in America that they do it, and it's kind of a byproduct of fox hunting and just the natural landscape. But they're solid fences, and they don't break, so you don't have any margin for error. So as a rider, it's definitely a lot more challenging. And there were some very, very good riders that were a little too heavy, actually, to be good hurdle riders, but, you know, over timber, they were fantastic.
Jonathan, we only have a couple minutes here before the break, but tell us a brief detail that first fantastic year of your steeplechase jockey career.
Well, I mean, it was kind of a dream, but it would be unfair for me to say that because I really didn't think things would go well that quickly. And when you're young and you're riding races, things just fly by very fast. Races go by very fast. And, you know, you kind of, you're at a loss for what really happened. So, like, I was just the beneficiary of being in the right place at the right time. You know, good horses trained by a very, very good trainer. And I had just enough ability to stay on some of those things and make sure I didn't get them in trouble. It wasn't until kind of a little bit later in my career where races started to slow down and make sense. And you know, the tactical part of racing kind of came more into play. You know, I was just kind of getting to understanding racing a little bit, you know, way later. Now, early on, it just kind of flew by.
We'll continue our visit with Jonathan Thomas after the short commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judges' choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use the monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcott. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And they're into the stretch, and it's Catholic Boy. Catholic Boy has taken the lead on the outside. Mendelssohn is full out toward the rail. It's five lengths back to Bravazo, who's now third. Then Vino Rosso and King Zachary on the outside. They're coming down to the 16th pole. Catholic Boy is pulling away. He's so impressive today, the others didn't even have a prayer. Catholic Boy rolls in the run. Happy Travers. Mendelssohn was second. Bravazo was third. And King Zachary was fourth in 201.94.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by Jonathan Thomas. Jonathan, we just heard the replay of the 2018 Travers, and your horse, Catholic Boy, who you train, took that race in such impressive fashion. What do you feel when you hear the replay?
Oh, it never gets old. It never gets old. That was you know, a pretty amazing experience, and you know, very fortunate to have a horse of that talent level and have everything go right.
From steeplechase jockey to multiple graded stakes winning trainer, Jonathan, we stopped during the break talking about your impressive career as a steeplechase jockey, and you mentioned, and I love the way you said this about when you're new as a jockey, when you're just starting out riding, and it all happens so fast, and I think everyone can relate to that who's ever ridden. And you said your career was about a year and a half, and towards the end things started to slow down and make sense. And of course, you took a couple graded stakes wins as a jockey as well, but unfortunately, you had a disastrous spill. And let's talk about that day a little bit and tell us what happened.
Well, it wasn't anything too dramatic from a spill standpoint. I was riding a horse I'd ridden a few times, and kind of an older horse who, you know, you kind of just stayed out of his way. He wanted to be a big keen and do a little bit much, so he would, you know, it was easy for him to kind of wear himself out in a pace scenario. And it was a stake. We're going down to the last fence, and he was getting a little bit tired. He had just done too much on the lead, and he had kind of shaken off a couple horses. And I asked, going into a fence, it's all kind of stride stuff. So you kind of meet stuff on a stride. And, you know, sometimes you can ask a horse to kind of stretch and leave the ground a little bit further away from a fence, trying to make up ground. And normally it's a great thing when you're coming from behind, but when you're kind of falling apart, it's a bit of a risk. And as a rider, I thought at the time it was the right move if it was going to mean placing. And I asked him, and he was tired, and he kind of picked the foot up, didn't really look at the ground, you know, and ended up in a fall. And, you know, it's a risk you take as a rider to kind of improve your position, but it probably wasn't the smartest move on my part. So I hit the ground, you know, not particularly bad, or, you know, didn't have a horse run over me, but the way I landed, I ended up getting a compression fracture in my L1 vertebrae in the bone. Could have gone one of two ways. It could have kind of popped out, but in my instance, it popped inward and put a lot of pressure on my spinal cord, which ended up in me being paralyzed for a while, probably 6 to 8 months. And you know, I was lucky where I had surgery very quickly to kind of alleviate the pressure. But, you know, it was kind of an unknown, you know, how the healing process was going to go.
I can't imagine that feeling, Jonathan. Obviously, we know the end result now. But at that time, when you realize you're paralyzed, I can't imagine the feeling.
I think, you know, I was 19 years old, and I didn't know enough to be scared of anything at the time. You know, now I'm a little bit more knowledgeable, having gone through it, and, you know, so I was learning about my injury in real time. So I didn't really have an opportunity to get frightened right away. I think I kind of started to really hit home a few weeks after the injury, you know, when things started to settle in. And, you know, we all handle things like that a little differently. I've always been very pragmatic. And, you know, the thrill or the beauty or the luxury of being able to ride horses in the afternoon comes at a physical cost, you know, and there's hardly a rider around that hasn't sacrificed some form of their body to riding, you know, and it's just part of the cost. But, you know, the benefit is amazing, and it's hard to explain to most people unless they've experienced it. So, you know, it's kind of an occupational hazard hitting the ground. So I was never angry about it because it's part of the risk, you know, and you acknowledge that at an early age. I met a lot of people that had been injured, and, you know, it's just part of it. I think for me, the hardest thing of all was losing my identity, you know, and losing kind of contact with horses and in the barn. And I wasn't afraid of not riding or not walking ever again. It was just not being able to work with horses. That was my first thing. It was odd. I got really upset about just losing that day-to-day, like, freedom.
Jonathan, I've told this story on the show before, but when I would get injured during my career, I would be so antsy and so frustrated, and I'd watch races, horses that I should have been riding, and I wasn't, of course, because I was laid up, and I would throw the remote at the TV. I would be so upset. And I can't imagine that almost cabin fever, and you're so antsy, and yet you can't do anything about it. That 6 to 8 month time period had to be really tough. And what did you do to deal with that?
I've always been very fortunate, you know, with friends and family, you know, being really supportive. And I think when you have friends and family that are also in horses, they understand. And they've been in those sort of scenarios or experienced that kind of trauma, where they're really supportive, and it's easy to talk to them. You know, I think the career paths that we've chosen are unusual to a lot of people, and, you know, there are not many things people are willing to do where they would actually risk their body for it. You know, it's a very unusual occupation that almost doesn't happen. You know, soldiers do it and athletes do it, and there's a couple others. So, you know, I was very fortunate where I didn't have parents or friends that didn't understand, that might have said, oh, I told you so, or you shouldn't have done that, or, you know. So I never, everyone made it very easy for me. And then, you know, I kind of started to really read about horses and some books, and really poured myself into magazines, Blood Horse in particular, and Thoroughbred Times, and really started to see that possibly, you know, that training or being an assistant trainer to a top-level guy was an obtainable goal. So, you know, from then I tried to chart a map, you know, into rehabilitation, and then, you know, finding a way to get back with horses and make a living out of it by not riding.
So looking at the bright side of things, when you were finally able to walk again, how did that come about? And I just can't imagine the feeling of relief you felt.
Yeah, it was very methodic. Nothing ever just came back. It was like things started with my toe moving, and I had my big, like, for whatever reason, my right big toe was the first thing that came back. And, you know, for weeks, I would try to move it and count and try to beat the count every day. And I know it sounds silly, but I'd wiggle my toe 10 times and I'd have a full sweat on my forehead, and it was really hard. And the next day I could do it 15 times, and all of a sudden my other toe could move. So it all came back very, very slow. And even when I could walk, it started off with like crutches and a walker. And so I kind of graduated from thing to thing. And the doctor at every step and maybe it's just their job, but, you know, he's like, look, you know, this might be your reality. This might, you know, you might need just a piece of equipment for the rest of your life. And I got lucky to just kind of graduate out of those things. And I think being young and being very fit and having a good support system and a great doctor, I mean, all those things kind of attributed to me being able to kind of get back, you know, to almost normal.
Jonathan, when I read this, doing my research for this show, I kind of rubbed my eyes because I wasn't sure if I was reading it correctly. But tell me if I'm correct, that you returned as an amateur rider in 2005 and competed internationally in France, Ireland, England, and Germany. Is that true?
I did, yeah. Now I, look, like I said, it's a part of your blood. It's a part of your identity. I mean, once I really got kind of strong enough again, I didn't feel comfortable trying to come back as a professional because I didn't feel that I was at the level of ability where I deserve to charge someone to ride their horse, you know, or that I could advertise myself as a professional. Now, in jump racing, there's a really healthy amateur segment to it where there are guys that are, you know, lawyers or doctors or, you know, work 6 days a week, and then they ride a couple races in the weekends, and some of those guys own their horses. So it's a very healthy, like, amateur segment, and it's really big in Europe. And every once in a while, some very good riders actually come out of there. So I felt comfortable kind of advertising myself as an amateur and coming back, and I think there's, like, a few years if you don't ride where you can kind of regain your amateur status if you had previously been a professional. And I think injury actually helps, like, legitimize your claim to being an amateur. And I just rode for fun. You know, I worked with horses and more in an assistant capacity. But, you know, every Saturday or Sunday I would go ride a couple races. And then I got lucky enough that I got to represent the U.S. in this amateur challenge that took us all over all over Europe, and I got to ride in Goodwood and Deauville and Newmarket and all these great places that I would never have experienced as a professional anyway, and it was incredible.
That's amazing, and I'm sure the experience riding internationally just helped your overall knowledge for racing, and of course would prove to be useful to your second career. But any big wins overseas?
I had a couple okay little wins, but I finished second, and I was beating a hare in the biggest amateur jump race in Germany on a horse I had just picked up, like, the day before. And we kind of missed the last. We didn't hit it exactly right, but I got up and literally had a head in front after the wire, but it was the biggest amateur jump race in Germany and just got nailed, or just missed by a whisker. Oof. So that would have been the closest to anything of note, you know, that I would have won over there.
Impressive, Jonathan. And when did you decide to retire from that? Or, I mean, are you still doing that, I guess, is the question I should ask.
No, I haven't ridden a racehorse or exercised or anything like that in probably about 10 years. I kind of got back home, and that was a seasonal thing, some opportunities started to present themselves, and I was offered an opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia and work for, he was at the time King Abdullah. He had a big racing stable there, and he had just purchased a horse called Premium Taff from John Kimmel. Very accomplished handicap horse, and they were looking for, you know, an American assistant of some kind to come over and join their team, and I got lucky enough to be asked, so I went over there for a year, and I had a great time.
After that year, Jonathan, you got a call from Todd Pletcher.
I did. I was fortunate enough. I had some friends that had worked for Todd, and, you know, they had reached out to me about a position that was opening, and you know, if I would meet with Todd, so I did, and it was at the Dubai World Cup the year Perlin won, and we had kind of a brief interview in the paddock and talked for a few minutes, and, you know, he asked if I'd come to New York and spend a little time with him and see if it's something I wanted to do, and, I mean, I didn't need to do that to know I wanted to do it, but I did, and you know, when an opportunity like that, especially for a young person, becomes available to work for a Todd Pletcher, I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's an absolute no-brainer. It took me 2 seconds to make up my mind. And it was probably the best, 5.5 years I've ever spent doing anything.
And what position did he give you?
I basically stayed at Belmont year-round. There's a year-round position at Belmont that is actually quite nice because, you know, our lives can be somewhat gypsy-like, you know, traveling up and down the East Coast, you know, through the winter and summer and spring and fall, so you could go to multiple destinations. But I ended up landing one of the rare year-round gigs, which I absolutely loved, because to me, Belmont Park is probably one of the nicest places to train a horse. And, you know, most all of the good race horses at some point on the racing calendar come through New York and Belmont in particular. So I love the kind of, you know, the tradition of the place and the good horses that came through there and kind of the continuity of being able to be in one place at one for a long amount of time. So I was very, very fortunate that position became available.
It's funny, Jonathan. I was galloping for Todd during that same time, but I galloped at Palm Meadows and Saratoga, Keeneland, and Churchill. So I never ran into you, but I do know during that time you got to work with the likes of Uncle Mo, Super Saver, Escandarea, and Devil May Care, just to name a few. And what did you learn from working with those kind of horses?
I mean, one, for sure, that if you want to compete at the highest level, you have to have those kind of horses, you know. And, I think Todd, on top of being an excellent horseman and trainer and communicator with his owners, he's got a very strong background in recruitment and, you know, buying and kind of making sure those young, talented horses come his way. And then, you know, to further add to the overall excellence of it, you know, they're coming into this really well-oiled machine that Todd's kind of cultivated over the years. So it was a lot of things. I mean, you know, you work for us, so you realize that it's, you know, it's very straightforward. You know, things aren't made to be any more demanding than they need to be, but you take very good care of your horses and your help and show up every day and do your best. And, you know, it's amazing how far that can take you.
You said you worked for him for 5.5 years. And when and why did you decide to go out on your own?
I felt, as a rider and as someone who had grew up with horses as a vehicle to ride, I felt one of the things I was really missing as a horseman was kind of the acquisition of young horses. And, you know, I rode my whole life, and I was always comfortable around horses. That's for Todd. And I went to a horse sale and looked at yearlings. And I literally felt like I was on a different planet, you know. And it made me really uncomfortable that, you know, here I was with all this horse experience. And I looked at 100 yearlings and couldn't tell you why I liked one or why I didn't like one or why it moved a certain way or kind of formed a function or athleticism. And, you know, it kind of dawned on me that if I wanted to train or that if I wanted to do bloodstock or whatever I wanted to do, like really spending time around horsemen that look at horses from the ground as opposed to being on top of them, was really important. So, you know, I had an opportunity to go work for Todd's father in Ocala and kind of attend the sales with them and have a chance to really kind of look at the developmental part of these programs, you know, which, like anything, football, basketball, you look at all these great coaches, they're good coaches, but a lot of them are the best recruiters. So they're really good at identifying young, talented athletes. And, you know, Todd's father is one of the best at it. And in that first crop, we, you know, our team bought Verrazano, and Shanghai Bobby was broke out of that crop. And I just kind of fell in love with getting a young horse in that had never had a saddle on and teaching them from the ground up. And as a horseman, it just made me feel very complete, you know, from kind of the beginning to the end. It just was another thing that I found I really enjoyed doing.
How did you end up at Bridlewood?
Bridalwood became, it was a, on the market. It was a nice historic farm with a lot of land and opportunity, but it was on the market. And, you know, sometimes these really big facilities, there's only about four or five people in the U.S. that can afford to have them. So I leased it and had an opportunity to start cultivating my own business. And about 6 months in, John Malone, who is Liberty Media, DirecTV, Sirius Radio, on top of other things, decided to buy the place and offered me an opportunity to stay on board with what business I had grown, and had given us the tools to kind of grow that out. And it was an amazing thing, another right place, right time sort of scenario. And what he and his farm manager, George Isaacs, have allowed us to do here has been amazing. I mean, they've put a new turf course, a new dirt track, a new uphill gallop, and, you know, all of a sudden we're sitting here with, you know, this amazing training facility. And, you know, we started to pick up some nice horses, and things just started to snowball.
How many horses do you have in training now?
Right now I have 140, and it's fluctuated. The first year was about 120, and at one time we got up to as many as 220. And, you know, we've been very fortunate where we've kind of cultivated some good relationships with some clients, and it's kind of more of an in-house thing now. And a public trainer, but in kind of a private setting, you know, where I have full use of, you know, a very, very nice place. It's almost like having my own Fair Hill or, you know, my own Palmettos. It's just, it's a wonderful place to be able to get horses ready. And, you know, it, looking back, it's been about 4.5 years, but, you know, our first group of horses, we had Gunrunner and Karina Mia and then Destin and then Taprit and then Catholic Boy and Moonshine Memories. And last crop was Newspaper or Record. And, you know, so it was just, it's been this amazing development, and it's kind of a dream come true because I'm getting to work with, you know, all these really, really talented horses. And it's been fun for our team, you know, seeing these horses go on and kind of graduate from our program and go on to do great things.
140 horses. That's a lot of horse flesh to be responsible for, and big names you just mentioned. So how do you manage the schedule of things? Obviously, Bridalwood is in Ocala, and you have trained quite frequently in New York. So what's your day-to-day schedule like?
Well, first and foremost, we're very fortunate. We've got an excellent team on the ground, and I couldn't do anything without a team. You know, and one of the great things working for Todd was kind of the day-to-day organization. You know, I've told him this. I've completely stolen the way he sets his schedule and does things, and kind of meshed it into what we do here. I don't see any reason trying to outsmart someone that's won 7 Eclipse Awards, so I've really just mimicked him as much as I possibly can. You know, so, you know, we're it's just getting up and staying on top of your work every day. And, you know, I tend to bring everything home to Florida during the winter to let everything regroup. We run horses, but more importantly, we let everything kind of get some R&R. And, you know, spring starts, we kind of start moving back up north into New York, and then we'll communicate between both places. If horses need to come back and get a little bit of a break or a little bit of a rest, I'd send them back to Bridalwood to do that, and then when they're ready to rejoin our group, they would also, you know, start to travel. But I'd say 90% of most all the horses training are actually done here, and then we would just put the finishing touches on them at the racetrack.
Jonathan, we only have a couple minutes left here, but I want to talk about Catholic Boy in just a little bit more detail. When you first saw him, did you know you had something special?
No. No, I did not. You know, I actually bought him as a weanling from the January sale. So when the first time I ever saw him, he was what they call a short yearling. So it's in January, so he would have been a yearling for roughly 2 to 3 weeks. I will say this, he physically was what I tend to look for in a young horse. You know, he was a nice, correct horse with a lot of, I call them just really good clean lines aesthetically. He was a very kind of like balanced and kind of a pleasing horse to the eye. And, you know, I loved his pedigree. He was more than ready out of a Bernardini mare, who was out of a Seeking the Gold mare. And I thought he just had a lot of kind of upside, and was fortunate enough where Mr. LaPenta allowed me to purchase him. And, you know, he became part of our family then, that day. And, we've basically had him ever since.
Yeah, I read you had the connection with John Panigot, Mr. LaPenta's racing manager. And when he broke his maiden so impressively, they basically said, well, we can't take him away from him now. So the rest is history, of course. And you mentioned the plan with him, of course, to have a very successful 2019 campaign. Hopefully we see him for a very long time, Jonathan. I think the fans would love that. And what are your future goals personally?
Just a continuation of things. I mean, we've been very blessed where, we've been supported by the right people, and, you know, we've had the right kind of horses jump up and win the right kind of races. So, I'm a realist, and like I said, I'm very practical. I've grown up with horses, so I realize there's a ebb and flow, and, you know, for all the good days you have, there's only 10 bad days invested. So, you know, honestly, continuation of what we're doing, and we can really do the best for our clients and our horses, and continue to do well, that would really make me happy. We had a great year that I think is going to be very hard to kind of improve on going into next year, but we're certainly going to do our best. And we've added some more two-year-olds to the program that I think we're going to get to keep and train next year, which is exciting. So hopefully we can just continue to get it right, a little more than we get it wrong.
Real quick, Jonathan, one last question. We have like 30 seconds left, but I know you're really busy. But to end on a fun note, what do you do for fun?
read. I like to read. Spend time outside. I mean, I'm not that exciting. Either horses or reading or being outside, pretty much.
Can't beat that, Jonathan. And we are wishing you all the best. Can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your day to do this show with us.
No, well, listen, I appreciate what you do. And, your work's really important, and you do a great job. And actually, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts and on the podcast stuff, but it's been great.
Jonathan Thomas, can't thank you enough. Wishing him all the best. Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and Express Bet. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.